started. Okay, so I thought I would share with you al-derech ha-drush, al-derech ha-chizuk, three ideas, I think time permitting, that are connected to the mitzvah of Parshas Bo, the mitzvah that is, according to the famous Rashi in the beginning of Bereishis, is the first mitzvah that is given at least to the Jewish people. We know, at least according to the Sefer HaChinuch, there are mitzvahs in Sefer Bereishis, but those are all given individually into the Avos, which is its own story. But in the words of the famous Rashi, you know, why didn't the Torah start with Parshas Bo? Because, of course, in Parshas Bo, we have the Pasuk in Perek Yud-Bet, Pasuk Bet, HaChodesh Hazel Lachem Rosh Chodashim. Moshe is commanded in the concept of a Jewish calendar in making Rosh Chodesh. The Mechilta, the Medrash, actually very vividly portrays this interaction between Moshe and Hashem. Hareu Levana Bechidusho. Hashem, you know, demonstrably shows Moshe the moon as it's becoming a Rosh Chodesh in its new state, as it's now beginning to wax in the new month. Kasher Hayerech Meschadesh Yelecha Rosh Chodesh, says Hashem to Moshe Rabbeinu. So very, very vivid. There are other midrashim that actually speak about why it's a Chodesh Hazeh, that highlight the fact that it's something very difficult for Moshe, which could be the source of a different type of a sikha. But I wanted to speak about something more basic, which is very popular, as I say, in the Sifrei Hadrush, you could say, and that is why the moon. Right? Judaism is like obsessed with the moon, which you don't appreciate it, so to speak, when you're in the Jewish bubble, because then we just take it for granted. But when you step out, either literally or even just intellectually, it really becomes jarring, or at least it accents the point, because the rest of the world couldn't care less, right? It's all about the solar calendar and the impact of the sun. And we still seem to be the people left behind, so to speak, who are still focused on the moon. So on the one hand, you could say, well, you know, we don't care, we have our own way, and that is kind of our answer to, like, lots of things, right? Avram HaIvri, the whole world is on one side, he's on the Aver of Sheni, but we know that that is not a sufficient answer for our, quote-unquote, obsession or focus on the moon, just because we actually very much do care about the impact of the sun, even halachically, and that, of course, creates the whole tension with our calendar, and that's why, for example, this year there's an extra long Chorosman, because we have to have an extra Adar, because we have to make sure that the seasons and the months correspond. So, I don't know about you, but I have a much simpler solution. Why not just have a solar calendar? Why don't, you know, you learn Kilchos Kiddush HaChodesh or the Rambam, or some of these sugyas and Masechas Rosh Hashanah, I mean, they are so complicated, and the level of expertise in these things that Chazal had to have, you know, certainly relative to their time, but even, you know, it's kind of stood up through time. It's just so complex. I happen to be not a math guy, so like my knees quiver even thinking about it. But even if you're a math guy, you probably more than me. Just how like complicated and impressive this is, and you know, twisting themselves, you know, into knots. And every month they have to decide, you know, how, you know, even on Rosh Chodesh, and then let alone every, you know, every year is it an Ibur HaChodesh? And like, why? Why not just make it more simply? Why not have a focus on the sun? Everything would be much, much, much simpler. Again, especially for the guys this year in yeshiva, it would be long charef man. It's always a challenge. So I wanted to offer again, al-derech ha-drush, this is not a pshat shir, three different ideas which are found in various mefarshim, each of which I think can be instructive, if not perhaps even inspirational, I would think, to anyone at any stage of life. But definitely when I was thinking about what to say, I had in mind, guys, at your various stages of life. So the first idea I wanted to share, which you can find in a number of Svarim, is something which on some level may be seen as a weakness, but actually I think you see that Judaism, halacha, hashkafa, we see it at least not as a weakness and perhaps even as a strength. And that is the scientific reality, which was already acknowledged by Chazal in multiple contexts, which is that unlike the sun, the moon is not an original source of light. The light of the moon is actually the reflection of the sun's light. The sun is an originator of light, a source of light. The moon is, quote, merely a reflection. The question is, again, on some level, our instinct might be to therefore downgrade or look down on the moon because of that. But that impulse is completely, you know, backs up against, again, the Torah's, Judaism's focus on the moon. So what's the lesson here? So I think that the lesson is to actually appreciate, and not undervalue as so much of the world does, to appreciate the ability to take something in, to absorb it, and then convey or transmit it to others. We live in an age, and to some extent you even have this in Torah, and that's why I want to sharpen it in particular, especially for B'nai Torah, which is obsessed with things that are new and obsessed with creativity. So on one level, it's maybe even a crass or a basic level, right, that's a tension that every religion, and certainly a religion such as Judaism, has with the modern world, because we're by definition conservative in the sense that we believe in Mesorah, like that's our starting point. Now is not the time to discuss halakha change and things like that. Obviously we've figured out a way to adapt to things too, but the default clearly is not new, but transmission of the old. And that is, again, you appreciate it, and we have to are challenged by it, given that the world around us thinks of it completely differently. Right? The more progressive you are, and again, if you're on college campuses, you are like living, immersed, unfortunately, in this mentality. It doesn't matter, like even before people measure the content or the merits of an idea, just the very fact that it's new, that they can call it progressive, becomes already a value, which it really should be value neutral. Either it's a good idea or it's a bad idea. And often the things that have been tried and true are tried and true for a reason. I don't just mean in a religious context, I mean even in social context. But that's not the mentality of the world that we live in. That's, on the most extreme sense, you could say, the highlighting of the moon. Again, the idea of not always looking for new, but rather the transmission or the reflection of the old from generation to generation, I think is symbolized. And I think that on some level, if I could kind of balance your current college and or your learning, I hope that's also current, but certainly the immersion that you had when you were in yeshiva, and as I say, hopefully keeping up your learning, that's also an issue, I think, even just in the base medrash. And it's not just a question of the base medrash versus the academy, that's what I just mentioned, but it's also even in the base medrash. And again, I think it's in many bate medrash, and I think it probably, you tell me if you think this was not your experience, but it's at least as much, if not more so, maybe in our base medrash, which is that there's such a, I won't say hyper, but such a veneration of chiddush and independent thinking and creativity, and clearly there's a place for that in learning, obviously, sometimes lose sight and don't often sufficiently appreciate the value of simply taking in past knowledge, absorbing that, integrating that, assimilating that, and when the right time comes, in whatever context you find yourself, then like the moon, reflecting that even to someone else, whether it will be Harusa's fellow students, and one day even hopefully your own children, and maybe one day you'll be teachers, or wherever it is. And what I want to get at, I think, which is very important, is that there's a difference between creativity and originality. I think we sometimes confuse those. You know, if, I don't know if you have, or if you haven't, hopefully one day you will, you read like Halachic Man of the Rav, or other things. What he venerates, what he speaks about, is creativity. It's not the same thing as originality. And I think that sometimes we make that mistake. Because often, I know it's been true certainly times in my own life, we get sometimes frustrated in our learning because maybe we can't come up with chidushim. And maybe our Rebbeim could, or maybe we have some friend or a Harusa who was always very original in his thinking. And if we, again, I speak for myself, sometimes if I'm not able to do that, somehow we've given such an emphasis on chiddush that we can somehow, you know, lose appreciation. And I remember this was really brought home to me in a very inspirational way, I'd say from all places, because why couldn't it have been, but I do remember at the time being surprised by it, was a sicha that was given in the Beis Medrash in YU 15 years ago, I guess, or more, actually, from Rav Schechter. And actually, he quoted Pascal, the 17th century French philosopher, scientist, mathematician, jack of all trades, Renaissance man. And if I remember correctly, more or less, I never looked this up originally in Pascal, so I'm giving you the cliché-ing from Rav Schechter, but he quoted him as saying, he would understand how come the world has such respect for or venerates, I think was the word he used, the poet. What words did the poet ever create? What words did the poet invent? And the answer, obviously, is none, unless it's like Rav Kook, who made up his own language or whatever, but you know, most people use the same language as everyone else does. So what's the greatness of a poet? How come we have poets we appreciate as being brilliant and inspirational? It's not in their originality of creating new words, but it's in what we would call, in the language of the yeshiva, the sidur hadvarim. Right? It's the organization. Two people can look at the same words and organize them in a different way. One way is bland and boring, and one way is creative, inspirational, and inspiring. That's creativity. Creativity doesn't mean necessarily inventing something bria yesh me'ayin. Creativity means being able to look at things and organize them in a way. So, again, I think whatever, again, each of you are in different colleges, schedules, but no matter where you are, including the guys who are the biggest learners in YU, right, there's always a tension of time, right? That's life. It'll still be true after you leave college, maybe even more so, right? So whatever little time you have left with all the other responsibilities you have, and you're committed to your learning, so sometimes, especially at the next stages of life, there can be a frustration of not having the time, the energy, or you know, maybe even just the ability to make these chidushim in ways that maybe you felt you could, or you looked up to and you idealized when you were younger in yeshiva. And on the one hand, I get that, it makes sense, but what I'm trying to tell you is that you shouldn't let it get it down. It's a mistake. Not only because there's a value in learning just for learning's sake and just taking in the old, but also because every one of you, this is for sure true, I don't have to know you to know this, every one of you have the ability to be creative. Originality, maybe not, I don't know. I don't have such an ability, honestly. But to be creative, to look at a sugya, to see that whether it's a Tanakh sugya or a Gemara sugya or whatever it is you're learning, and organize it in a way, just because you and Harus or you and someone else in the yeshiva looked at the same sources does not mean that you would organize it or frame it or understand it in the same way. And that is absolutely a form of creativity, which A, you should be proud of, and B, should energize you in your learning. So all of this, more or less, is what I would like to say is the first idea that is highlighted by the moon. The fact that we focus so much on the moon, not despite the fact that it's not the source of its own light, it is merely a reflection, but adarabah, on the contrary, there's something very powerful and instructive and educational about the fact that the moon is a reflection of light, taking something from someone else, and so to speak, paying it forward. That's idea number one. Number two, some of the Mefarshim point back, not from the lesson in Parshas Bo, but the lesson we can learn to Parshas Bo from Parshas Bereishis. And of course, that's in Perek Aleph in the creation story, when we're first introduced to the new moon. And with along with the sun here, the moon is described as the Me'orot HaGedolim. There are these big celestial beings, the sun and the moon. And what is mentioned as an afterthought in the Pasuk? Ves HaKochavim. Exactly. So the Ibn Ezra already notices, and I don't know if anyone asked this before him, but already notices, it seems peculiar. You know, I don't know what the Torah's red line was, or where the demarcation was of big and small Me'orot. But once the moon has made it, so why are the stars left out? Right? We know, and apparently already so did the Ibn Ezra, there are many stars that are actually much bigger than the moon. So if the moon qualifies for being a Me'or HaGadol, so why wouldn't the stars? Why do the stars? It gets very noticeable in the Pasuk. They seem to be excluded from that action. So the Ibn Ezra says something very, very beautiful. Again, sometimes we just think of the Ibn Ezra as this like strict, Pashtan, and some people may dafka like that, but often people find that less exciting than some other Perushim HaLa Torah. But sometimes there's some real Hashkafa, if you will, a real Machshava in the Pshat, and I think this is a perfect example of it. Here the Ibn Ezra says, because what you see from the Torah is that size is not necessarily what matters. What makes the sun and the moon gadol is not their size. In that case, the moon would be, the stars would be also. What makes them gadol? The benefit they give to people. Why does the moon look so big compared to the stars? Simply because it's closer to the earth. Right? It's true that there are stars that are much bigger than the moon, but because they're so far away, so we can barely see them, they look small. And again, I'm not an expert in astronomy or anything like that, but and I don't know if how much Ibn Ezra was either in the modern sense, but I think on a simple level, at least because I'm a simple guy when it comes to science, I think it's true and very, very powerful that the benefit, whether it's in light or gravity or other things that we get from the moon, right, is obviously far more considerable and significant than what we may get. Again, I don't know enough to know what exactly individual stars give us, but clearly, I think, it's not what we get from the moon. The reason that we consider the moon the Me'or HaGadol, says the Ibn Ezra, is because of the benefit that it gives us. That's what makes something big. That's what makes something great. And here I think there's clearly a very important mussar for us all to take. And that is that clearly, again, perhaps this is part of the focus that we have in Judaism on the moon. And that is that we should realize that it's not size per se. It's not strength or, you know, brute force or brute strength that matters. It's what you do l'tov with that strength. It doesn't really matter, you know, the size of your bank account. It matters what you do with what you have in that bank account. If you're using that for good, so that's godless. That makes you a gadol. If you're hoarding it, or you're simply using it for even worse than hoarding it, you're using it for bad things, so it doesn't matter how big you are, how strong you are, how smart you are, right? Again, it's true in yeshivas, not just this yeshiva, and all yeshivas, it's true in probably in universities, there's a certain like obsession with smarts, right? And this guy, oh, he's a genius, and oh, I know that so-and-so's a... Again, obviously, if you're in an intellectual environment, whether it's a college or a yeshiva, so it makes sense that there's a certain, you know, benefit, clearly, to being bright and being able to do things. But it really, really, if it stops there, it's so, so missing the point. It does not matter in the big picture how smart you are. What it matters is what you do with your smarts. Just like in the end, it won't really matter in terms of your life you've lived with how much money you accumulate or how other things. It matters what you do with those things. It's a completely different way of living. I remember, I think I read this once in the writing maybe of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, but if the story is incorrect, then blame me, not him. But I think that's maybe where I saw it, that there was a story they say about Baron Rothschild, that someone once asked him, how much are you worth? And he gave a number, I don't know what the number was, but it was clearly a number that was obviously less than the person knew he had. Right, so it would be like, you know, if you would ask somebody, you know, who's a billionaire, and they said, you know, I don't know, 25 million. Like, you know, you might not know, if you ask, I don't know, Bill Gates, you know, every month, you know, or every year, certainly goes up, it goes down, you know, he has investments. So maybe you don't remember, is he worth 30 billion this year or 50 billion? But when he says 100 million, you like, you know that's, you're like, that's way off. So somebody asked Rothschild, like, how much are you worth? And he gave a number which was clearly much lower than the person knew was even in the ballpark. So the person responded, like, what are you talking about? That can't be. So what is that number? He said, that's the amount of charity I gave this past year. So the guy looked at him like he was crazy. He says, no, you didn't ask me how much I have in the bank. You asked me how much am I worth. I'm not worth what I have in the bank. I'm worth what I do with that money. And that's the number that I gave you. So again, I don't know for sure that's a true story, but the idea is certainly true. On the pasuk of Vayikhu li truma, right, everyone asks the question, shouldn't it be Vayitnu li truma, not Vayikhu li truma? So I'm not mistaken, I think if you take a look, the Beis Halevi of HaTorah on that parsha, that's exactly the explanation he gives. Because you should know, says the Beis Halevi, this is what they're teaching the Jews in the time of building the Mishkan, that the money that you have that you'll give to good things like building the Mishkan, that's actually the only time that you truly have it. It's paradoxical, says the Beis Halevi. You only truly have money when you give it away. Because the zechus, or the broadly speaking, the good that you do, that will be permanent. Then it's sitting in the bank account, so we know, here today, gone tomorrow. And first of all, even if the money doesn't go, you'll be gone at some point. So what does that mean to say it's my money? Says the Beis Halevi, that's what the Torah is teaching you. Vayikhul, you want to take it, you want to make it your money? Give it away. Do good things with it. So that's, again, I think a similar vein. That's, again, going back to Ebenezer on the moon. What makes the moon more hagadol? Why? I'm suggesting, perhaps, is there such a focus calendar on the moon? It teaches us this very valuable lesson. That it doesn't matter how big, how strong, how wealthy, how smart. What really matters is what you do with those gifts, with those talents. And last but not least, I want to mention an idea which I think is very, very powerful and is always resonant to me. And that is an idea that, on the one hand, you see in many darshanim, and then just this week I was giving chug on Tuesday to the boys, and I was teaching them the halachos of Kiddush Levana, and actually I found that this idea is quoted in the Aruch HaShulchan in Hilchos Kiddush Levana, and that is an idea that perhaps the reason there's such a focus on the moon, per se, is because the fact that the moon waxes and wanes on a monthly cycle. The fact that, again, obviously it's our perception of the moon, it doesn't actually change size, but it seems to. We don't have this with any other thing. like the, we have with the moon, that you know, on a daily and certainly eventually on a monthly basis, it seems to be getting bigger than smaller, than bigger than smaller, that many, again, you find this in the Aruch HaShulchan, even, which is interesting, but also in other Sifrei Drush, that the moon is a symbol of Jewish history. The Jewish history is a roller coaster. Not everyone likes roller coasters. Right? If you're lucky, you had like as a kid, like, you know, if you were one of those kids who liked roller coasters, then you had to be lucky to have a parent or an older sibling who did, or else you could never go on them. Right? So I'm very fortunate that my older kids like roller coasters. So even though when they were young, I had to take them because my wife was certainly not taking them. But now that they're older siblings, they take the younger siblings, and I get to sit, you know, on the side. Hodel Hashem ki tov. But you know, at this age, I can't do the roller coaster thing anymore. But I have kids who are a little younger than you, so they can then take, you know, my younger kids even on the roller coasters. So not everyone likes a roller coaster, right? A lot of us in life would wish things would just be stable and straight. But guess what? We don't get to choose. You can choose if you go on the roller coaster, the amusement park or not. But life, for the Jewish people, and even to be perfectly frank, on an individual level, we don't get to choose. And again, you have this. It's just a fact when you look back retrospectively at history, but many darshanim, midrashim have been saying this for many, many years, that there seems to be an inexorable metaphysical law of history. And that Jewish history is kind of like that. Jewish history is like the moon. It waxes and it wanes. And there's two mussar points, there's two lessons for all of us to take in that. Number one is that when it's good, we have to appreciate it. It's just human nature, it's psychology 101. We're all lulled into thinking when we're in good times that it's going to last forever. It's, again, there are people who are pessimists by nature who, you know, and again, I had grandparents who were survivors of the Holocaust, so that type of an extreme trauma kind of prevented them from kind of ever thinking that the good would last because they were so worried about when would things change. But I think for most people who've had a normal, healthy, comfortable life, so it's human nature, whether it's a defense mechanism, whatever the thing is, but when things are good, we kind of tell ourselves that, you know, we take them for granted, let's just put it that way. If we think about it, we know it can't last forever, that may be true, but I just think very often in life we don't appreciate things. I think that's not a controversial statement. So number one is when you realize, and you take step back, you zoom out, and you take the big picture of you, especially of Jewish history, so you have to appreciate the good times. You have to appreciate that. Because unfortunately, it's not always going to be like that. How do I know that? Because it's just the law of history. On a national level, you know, we're basically, you know, it's the best of times, the worst of times, right? You could certainly find things, trust me, I know, to quibble with. There are challenges, internal challenges we have now, external challenges we have now, and depending on what perspective you're taking, on some level we have some unprecedented difficulties as a people. But on certain perspectives, certainly on a national level, we're living at an unprecedented time where the moon is waxing tremendously, right? My father, for years, always used to point out, even before living in Israel was a dream, let alone a reality for me, I remember just talking about, like, if you just know a little bit of Tanakh, he didn't go to Gush, but at least he studies Tanakh anyway. So if you know a little bit of Tanakh, and you don't know Jewish history, you know how small a percentage of Jewish history did the Jewish people have a sovereign state in Israel. I mean, it's unbelievable. It seems like the most natural thing when you read Tanakh, that's what it should be, in Eretz Yisrael, with a Melech, with a Beis HaMikdash, or whatever. But in retrospect, you look back at history, it's a sliver, a fraction of Jewish history did we have this. And for some reason, which no one can possibly give me the answer to, you and I are lucky enough to have spent our entire lives, our entire lives with a modern, sovereign Jewish state. You and I are young enough that we've spent our entire lives living with Yerushalayim, the Kotel, Hebron, all these places under Jewish sovereignty and accessible. Again, you have to stop. Every now and then you got to take a step back and realize this was unthinkable 60 or 70 years ago, let alone 600 years ago. Unthinkable. The flowering of Torah, the number of people learning, there's so many good things. We have to appreciate that because it's not a given that it'll stay. We have to work hard and not only take advantage of it, but then that Hakar Satov should kick into Hishtadlus. In other words, then we have to then do things as much as we can to try to preserve the good, because we know Jewish history is not a given. And of course, Mitzad Sheni, we also have to realize that when and if we find ourselves in a time where the moon seems to be waning, a dip, difficult times, terrorism, war, innocent victims, which we're certainly going through on a national level now, and we have been as long as any of us can remember. So this also should give us chizuk. And it's true, it's been kind of an inexorable law of Jewish history as well, that whenever you have something really, really, when the Jewish people hit the mat, they bounce right up. And again, the last two generations are a perfect example of that, and the as extreme as you could possibly imagine with the Holocaust and the state of Israel. Again, I'm not speaking causally now. I'm not God. I don't know why things happen. But Lamaisa, this is what happened. There was a Holocaust, and then there was a miracle called the state of Israel. To be blind to the association between the two is not the same thing as saying, I don't know why, what the relationship is. I don't know if anyone knows the exact causal relationship. I'm not pretending to know. But that's not the same thing as having your eyes open to see the association. And on a much smaller scale, that's been true throughout history. No matter how difficult things are, it's always been just a matter of time, or through either with our own ingenuity and or obviously ultimately because of Hashem's blessing, we've been able to pick ourselves up. It's been true throughout the Gola, throughout the diaspora, and it's certainly been true in Israel. And again, just last but not least, this is on the macro level. I think, I don't want to be the old fuddy-duddy in the room, but I'm slowly old enough, and to some extent, maybe some of you guys are, or you're certainly close to being old enough, to know that this is true in your personal lives as well. Like, no one's life is perfect, right? We often, again, this is another classic thing, which is that we're always convinced that someone else has a better life, and the neighbor, the friend, the cousin, whoever, if I just had their parents, if I just lived in their community, and their house, with their this, and with their that, you know, things must be great over there. Right? Even people of happy lives think that way, let alone people who are born into difficult situations. And again, it's all, again, as you get older, you realize it's all just a mistake. Lots of people have lots of blessings, but there's no one's life that's fully and completely and exclusively blessed. Everyone's life has ups and downs, blessings and challenges. That is really, again, on some level, it is the lesson not only of the national people, but it is really true of life. And again, I think that the mussar is the same on an individual level. Appreciate the brachos, appreciate the blessings, say thank you for them, work hard, don't take that for granted, but also to give yourself chizuk, even if you are having something difficult in your life, to realize that that's not permanent either. That life is a cycle, it's a little bit of a roller coaster. Part of what religion is the seatbelt for the roller coaster. It's what we have to hold on to give ourselves meaning and give ourselves direction. But that really is a lesson of life, and it's not static. Ultimately, it comes from Hashem, but at least as far as we can tell, a lot of it is given to our decisions. Kol bidei shemayim, chutz miyira shemayim. And based on our decisions and our behaviors, that not only can sometimes impact the environment that we're in and the actual phenomenon, but it can always impact how we deal with it. You know, there's an old cliche, or I don't know, somebody made up the idea, you know, you can't control the hand you hit, but you can control how you deal with that hand. And as you probably already know, things become cliche because they're true. And there's a lot of truth even in that corny cliche. And life may be a roller coaster, and you know, again, just to give one last example, unfortunately, some of you may know, I don't know if you heard this, some news yesterday, a girl, I believe was a graduate of Ramaz, was a student of my wife's, Daniela Mafson, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha. She died in a horrific accident yesterday in Honduras. She was a student of my wife's, incredibly, incredibly close with my wife. They just spoken recently. And we literally woke up this morning. That's how I woke up. That was my alarm clock. It was my wife screaming when she got the phone call. A very, very difficult period. And for anyone who's close, obviously her family mostly, but to anyone who was connected to her, just a horrible, seemingly senseless tragedy. So the moon waxes and wanes in individual lives, and there are painful things, but the chizuk we have to take from any of these challenges is there's always some light at the end of the tunnel. We have to do our best with the people who are in pain and for ourselves to get there. But I hope, again, these words should be a little bit of a, I hope it's a chus for her and for her family, but they should have chizuk and nechama, a measure of it at least, I hope, as much as possible. And then we should all take chizuk, again, from the beautiful symbolism of the moon. And again, the 3 points that we mentioned, the difference between reflecting and creating, creativity versus originality, which is an important message, the idea of it's not so important how big or how strong you are, but what you do with that. And last but not least, the roller coaster, the waxing and waning of life and of Jewish history. All right, everyone, have a great week. Have a great Shabbos.